Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today we're going to do, as we often do, in fact, over the years, concentrate on a disease that's so prevalent in our area and so dangerous, diabetes. And our guest today is Craig Harness. And Craig is a professor of human genetics and epidemiology at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. And Craig, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I thought growing up that I saw members of my family in England who had a diabetic condition and, you know, they just watched what they ate and they watched, you know, what they did, exercise, and they seemed to live forever. So I never thought of it as a bad disease until I came here to El Paso. And my wife works in a hospital, and we see amputations, blindness, kidney failure. It's a horrible disease. Why? Yeah. Why are we so little advanced already? I mean,
well, I think we're just realizing how horrible a disease it is. It affects particular populations much more often than others, and it's increasing in frequency so rapidly that we can't keep up with how rapidly it's changing. And so more and more people are getting it. They're getting it earlier. They're having the complications more often, and so it's taking just kind of a devastating toll. The problem is diabetes itself doesn't make you feel so bad, and it's not listed as the main cause of death or that kind of thing. We die of heart attacks and strokes and the like, and those things often are because you had diabetes, and that's right. The underlying causes.
And it's a non-communicable disease.
Yeah.
Right. So before we get into it, I mean, because we've got a lot to talk about, but I want a little bit about Craig. How did you're a PhD working in a medical school, how did you get into science? What were those little driving forces?
Yeah, it's hard telling. I always liked health. And growing
I like to be healthy.
Yeah, and growing up I thought, well, I wanted to be a doctor and, you know, go to medical school and things. And that seemed a good plan all the way through high school until I started undergraduate studies and I took a genetics class. And I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Right.
And I liked the professor that taught it, and we just hit it off. And so then I took another genetics class. And then I took another one and took a human genetics class. And before I knew it, that's what I was doing, was genetics, and loved every moment of it. Then I stayed, and after my undergraduate degree, I did a master's degree in genetics and human genetics. And well, that was pretty good. And so then we decided, well, we'll go and we'll do a PhD.
In genetics.
In genetics, in human genetics. And, you know, and I thought the idea of, you know, I was interested in health and helping people and doing those kinds of things. Here was a role that I could play that would be different. And we could try to understand what causes diseases, not rare diseases, the rare genetic diseases that we're often familiar with, but let's look at those diseases that really impact us. Heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, obesity. There's a genetic component to all of those, and let's figure out what we could do to make a contribution to those. And so that's where we started.
Well, as an undergraduate, when you first sort of got turned on by this professor, did you then get the opportunity to do undergraduate research in this area?
I did some with him. I did a rotation kind of thing with him. Mm-hmm. And then I went
to— Where was this?
This was at BYU in Provo,
right.
Utah. And in fact, what really endeared me to genetics was he told us if you got a 95 or above on all of your exams, you wouldn't have to take the final. And I thought that was good. And I got a 31 on the first exam. And I was above average.
Hey, I know this scenario very well.
And,
right, that first exam, yeah, you know, is often the eye-opener.
Yeah, and by golly, this is kind of fun. And, you know, we liked it. And so we just kept pursuing it. So I actually worked with him in a master's degree as well.
Okay. And PhD in BYU?
No. And I went to the University of Michigan
and
did a master's degree in statistics, or the PhD in human genetics.
Okay. So it's a disease, and it's a genetic disease, although there are forms of diabetes which are not genetic.
Yeah.
So let's start there. Why is there a difference? Why are there two forms of diabetes?
Yeah, so there are even more than that, but the two main forms is there's type 1 diabetes, which usually occurs in children, is when it has its onset. Type 1 diabetes, for some reason, the body starts to recognize the cells that make insulin as being foreign, and it destroys those cells. And the person can no longer produce insulin, and they're going to have to take insulin to survive for the rest of their life. And so prior to 1921, when Banting and Best discovered insulin, their life expectancy was measured in months. Now we
at
have
the onset of the disease.
After the onset of the
and
disease.
And there was no clue as to when that could be. It could be 5 months, 5 years, 15?
Yeah, it's usually between 5 years and 15 years, and okay. It's the same. It has a very rapid onset. People go into a coma, basically, and they're taken to the hospital, and they measure their glucose, and it turns out they've got extremely high blood sugar, and they're diagnosed as not having insulin, and they have type 1 diabetes. And of all of the diabetes that's out there, about 5 to 10% of diabetes is type 1. And then there's type 2 diabetes, where people, they produce lots of insulin. Their pancreatic cells, they work just fine. It has an age of onset that's in your 40s and 50s, sometimes 60s or 70s even. You do just fine for all those years. And then you start to not be able to utilize the insulin that's produced properly. And used to be you'd have a meal and we all eat and our sugar levels go up. And it doesn't make us feel bad at all. Our sugar goes up. We produce insulin. Our sugar goes back down. Well, with time in people who have type 2 diabetes, their sugar goes up. The insulin goes up. But instead of helping move that sugar into the cells, it doesn't work as efficiently. And they become what's called insulin resistant. And it takes more and more insulin to move that sugar into the cells. And with time, we swamp the system and we end up in a constant state of having high blood glucose. Now, again, high blood glucose doesn't make you feel bad. You know, we drink a Coke and your sugar goes up and you don't feel so bad. But prolonged exposure to high levels of sugar in our blood then causes a series of complications. And that's where it's the leading cause of blindness, the leading cause of end-stage kidney disease. So kidney dialysis.
How do you go from high blood sugar to blindness, for example? Yeah. What, is this well understood?
No. So we know that it occurs gradually over time. If you take kind of a cross-section of people who have type 2 diabetes, and I study type 2 diabetes, after they've had it 5 to 10 years, about 50 to 60% will have some of the eye complications.
So what are those? I mean, so, loss of peripheral vision, yeah, macular degeneration?
Actually, it starts it's much simpler than that. They just have on the small vessels on the retina, the back of the eye, they'll have a small aneurysm, kind of a little balloon, and it'll leak some fluid. It doesn't interfere with vision. It doesn't cause any problems. But when you get 5, 10, 20, 30 of these, or many more than that, then you start to get swelling. And over a period of time, and it occurs in most people over years, it can advance to more severe stages, so much so that the body recognizes, man, something's going on. I'm not getting the proper circulation on my retina, and it sends out new blood vessels. And with time, it can actually tear the retina, and that's what causes the blindness. Now, that's the bad news. Now, the good news is most people with diabetes, they don't go blind. Most will develop a little bit of retinopathy. If they check their eyes, have their eyes checked once a year, then an ophthalmologist or an optometrist can look and say, well, you know, it's advancing, and treatment can be done to save vision, which is great. So as long as people will do that.
So that's a treatment to the eye. It's nothing related back to the original diabetic
condition. No, it's a treatment
condition.
Of the eye itself, right. And it'll prevent the development then of the blindness. And so you don't have to go blind if you just take care of the disease.
So what about the kidney failure or the kidney problem? Is there a clear relationship there?
Same thing. Over a period of time, kidney function starts to change. We don't know all of the reasons why that happens. And pretty soon, we're not filtering out the impurities as we should, and we end up in kidney failure. So it's a leading cause of kidney disease. But again, not all diabetics get that. The real predictor, there's two main predictors of both the eye disease and the kidney disease. One is how long you've had diabetes. We can't do a lot about that. But the other one is how well you control your blood sugar. And those who maintain more normal blood sugars take their medications, whether it's an oral agent or insulin, they can control their blood sugar, delay and prevent the onset of these complications. But it's one of those things you have to constantly keep at it. You have to monitor your blood sugar. You can test it every day and see where you are to make sure that you're keeping your blood sugar in a normal range.
And this is all associated with type 1. And yet also when we get into more clear description of type 2, it's the same.
This same complications in both type 1 and type 2. And the key in both of those is that we control our blood sugar.
So the type 1, in a sense, there's not much you can do in a preventive feature.
Once you have it, That's it.
You do the treatment, you go through the regimen, you do your
forever.
Exercise. And, right. Now go to type 2.
But type 2, because it's mostly associated as we get obese, the more obese an individual is, the heavier we get, and the less exercise we get, the more resistant we become to our insulin.
And why is that?
Well, we don't know.
Okay.
It just appears that we've got a system that goes awry. It doesn't like to be sedentary. It doesn't like to have all of the extra fat and the stores of things that go on in fat. And so we end up developing type 2 diabetes.
So if I could digress for a minute,
sure.
Then type 1 diabetes, I mean, I could imagine that it could be found in animals. Yeah, you know, because there's a genetic feature which we'll come to.
Yeah.
Type 2 diabetes. Are there any animals that exhibit type 2 diabetes?
Yeah, there's some animal models. There's some
Well, you can induce it perhaps.
Yeah,
but
you can induce
out in
it
the wild. They'd be dead if they were too obese. Couldn't run away.
I mean, dogs and cats actually will develop diabetes, and people will treat their dogs and cats. But we don't look much at that.
Okay.
So.
But now, there are then these genetic predispositions.
Yeah.
And are we in a position today in the beginning of the, we're one decade into the 21st century, of being able to sort of screen people at birth and say, hey, here is a potential predictor of diabetes 1 or 2, and let's do something about it straight away?
Yes and no. So we have with type 1 diabetes, again, which is the one that only explains 5 to 10% of all diabetes, it's what's called an autoimmune disease. So our immune system goes awry and attacks the pancreatic beta cells. Those are the cells that make insulin. And because it's an autoimmune disease, there are some specific genetic markers in a system called the HLA system that individuals who have particular forms of that are predisposed to have type 1 diabetes. And those genetic markers can be tested for. I don't think we're to the point yet that we ought to do routine testing of all newborns for this, because the vast majority don't have these and don't develop type 1.
But the ability's
coming.
But if you do find someone with that predisposition, is it 100% that they will develop, or is it just a small fraction?
It's a small fraction.
So there's an environmental trigger somewhere later.
Yeah. So if we look at identical twins, for example, where they're genetically identical to one another, if one of them develops type 1 diabetes, then about 40% or 50% of the other twin will also develop it. But that means 40 to 60% don't. And so there's got to be environmental triggers.
And twins are always a key feature for epidemiologists.
Oh, yeah.
And the lay public likes to read about this, too.
Yeah.
Right? Twins that were separated in 1 hour and they suddenly find each other later on and they've got so much in common.
Yeah.
But then those little interesting features where they've diversed.
Yeah. And so that's kind of the genetics of type 1 is caught up in that. We've learned lots in the last few years. Science has been amazing and genetics has been more amazing than anything I've ever seen. We have technologies that we see in the newspaper now that the whole genome has been sequenced multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty fantastic. The Human Genome Project finished in 2003, kind of the first pass at this, at a cost of about $3 billion.
Well, for $10,000, you can go tomorrow and get your own complete genome.
So the costs are being driven down, and within 2 to 3 years, it'll be $1,000 to do what cost just 10 years ago, $3 billion. So pretty amazing. So we have access to all of the genome and to be able to look at things. But then we find, as we look at the genome, it's complicated. If I compare my genome to your genome, the two of us will differ at the DNA level at about 10 million different sites. Now, we have to try to sort out between those 10 million sites which one or two or five or 10 of those may predispose me to develop diabetes more than you might be predisposed to diabetes. But you might be more predisposed to hypertension than I am. And so it's caught up in there. And then how those 10 million differences, which ones interact with our environment, our diet and our lifestyle, then to produce diabetes? That's hard.
We're going to take a break at that point. And we'll be back. This is Keith's Panel with Craig Harness, and we're talking about diabetes.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Hey, Dave, the guys at Google are putting out some really nifty inventions.
Yeah. Last year, they introduced Google Glass, where users can check email, read maps, all with a pair of glasses.
They're also testing driverless cars, and now something just as unexpected, a contact lens that measures blood sugar in the wearer's tears.
Wow. For diabetics, that's got to be exciting. Imagine not having to poke yourself several times a day to check your blood sugar level. It's invasive, inconvenient, and the supplies get expensive.
But diabetics now don't have a choice if they want to stay healthy. When their sugar or glucose level is either too low or too high, they can suffer serious health problems over time. Some diabetics have their feet amputated, lose their vision, and die from kidney failure.
So their glucose levels must be kept within relatively strict limits. But people aren't always good about their medical regimen, so Google's contacts could do the work for them. It has tiny wireless chips and a glucose sensor embedded between two soft contact lenses to take sugar readings once per second.
The electronics are so small they look like glitter, and the antenna is thinner than a human hair. Google's trying to incorporate tiny LED lights to alert the wearer when glucose levels are off. They've completed some clinical trials to refine the technology. Part of that is to create apps that store the measurements on a smartphone for the users and the doctors.
If the contacts turn out to be accurate and affordable, what a difference it would make to over 20 million American diabetics whose numbers are rapidly growing.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to the Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Craig Harness. And Craig is a professor of human genetics and epidemiology at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. And we're talking about diabetes. And we just got to the point where, yes, there are predispositions, there are genetic markers, but we're not clever enough to know how some of those turn on and some of those turn off.
That's right.
Let's go to the type 2 then. Is there a predisposition also?
There is.
And is that clearer or less clear? Or?
Again, yes and no. If we look at identical twins for type 2 diabetes, if one of the twins develops type 2, almost 80 to 90% of the other twin will also develop type 2 diabetes. We're not sure exactly what that means, other than there's a genetic susceptibility to individuals that tell us that, well, if there is such a susceptibility, we ought to be able to go search for those genes and find them. And that's what I've spent the last 29 years doing, is knowing that we've got a susceptibility to diabetes. Let's see if we can find those genes.
And you found some, I hope. 29 years is a long time to search.
Yeah, we're slow learners. We've made lots of progress.
You're not a slow learner. You're a slow searcher. Searching is difficult.
Yeah, and it's changed.
It's called research.
Yeah, and just to give you an idea how much science has changed and genetics has changed, when I first started in 1981, we collected family data and we collected blood samples and we threw the DNA away. Because we didn't know what to do with DNA at the time. And everybody threw DNA away. We knew how to do the ABO blood group or the RH blood group, and so we tested those, but we didn't know what to do with the DNA. Whereas today, we can look at the DNA for this variation, these 10 million differences between you and me, and start to ask which ones of those are predisposing to diabetes.
You know, I just heard recently, going back to the DNA, throwing it away, but we're very clever now. We can do it on bones that are 30, 40,000 years old.
Yeah.
They were talking about Neanderthal bones, and they found that they bred, and we had developed from their breeding habits, right?
So DNA is pretty amazing stuff. It hangs around, and you can get it, and you can get it from individuals as well. So
tell us about this type 2, because, I mean, that is where the explosion, and it's all to do with obesity and lack of exercise. And that seems to the lay non-obese person, hey, come on, get off the stool.
Yeah, diet and exercise.
Don't get it, right. Yeah. What's the problem? What do you see from what you've learned genetically that you want to transmit to the public, and yet there's a resistance out there?
The first is that we know that there are some populations that are more predisposed to develop diabetes than other populations. And so clearly along the border between Texas and Mexico, the Hispanic population, Mexican-American population, is particularly predisposed to diabetes.
Is the same true with a Hispanic population that's moved away, like to say Canada?
Yes.
Okay, so it is truly genetic. It's not to do with genetics and perhaps diet.
Yeah. There has to be some diet involved in this, but it doesn't matter if we look at the Mexican-American population that lives on the border or in Colorado or Michigan or Washington or Canada, they have high increased rates of diabetes.
But I got to interject, and I've done this so many times on this program, about the Pima Indians of Arizona. They have incredible, 90%, I think, I've heard. And yet their cousins in Sonora have vanishingly small amounts.
Yeah. We know that with the right environment, we don't have to have diabetes. If we look at the turn of the last century, 1900, the rate of diabetes in Native Americans, the Pima Indians, or Mexican Americans was probably less than 5%, less than 3%, very low. And so over a 100-year time period, we've seen just a flourishing of this disease. Well, I can tell you from a genetic standpoint, we don't change genes over a 100-year time period. And so the environment changed. So if we want to do away with diabetes, all we have to do is reproduce the diet and lifestyle of the late 1800s, and we won't have diabetes. Well, we're not willing to do that. We all like the conveniences we have. We like having freezers. We like having cars, air conditioning, all of the rest of this. We like jobs that don't kill us from working so hard and so physically demanding. So we're not going to go back and do that. So we look at, well, what's happened in the last 100 years. Populations have started to develop more diabetes. Mexican American and Native American populations are among those populations. African Americans also. Other populations have not done so. Except it now looks like in the last 20 to 30 years, other populations are starting to come along as well. They're starting at a very low rate of diabetes. The Mexican-American population 30 years ago, lifetime risk for developing diabetes was probably about 30 to 40%. That's huge. But today, lifetime risk is probably 60 to 70%. And what changed in the last 20 years? Well, our diets have changed. We certainly have access to cheap, high-caloric, really good-tasting, supersized meals.
Is the supply in Mexico? I mean, is the lifetime risk there as high?
There aren't as many studies that have been done in Mexico. Those that have been done 15, 20 years ago indicated that it was less there. But we see the population changing. Mm-hmm. And so we actually are seeing diabetes double in frequency in almost every population in the world over a period of 20 to 30 years. And it appears it's going to continue to do that.
What about in Polynesia? I mean, I used to be a sumo fan when I lived in Japan.
Yeah.
I mean, and these lads, they're big.
They're big.
All right?
Yeah.
Is that an issue in Polynesia?
It is, yeah. Diabetes is a major problem
and
there.
And that's not a genetic feature then?
No, it's size, but why are they so large? And where does the obesity come from? Again, there's a genetic susceptibility to all of these things.
Oh, do you know that?
Well,
you think so. I mean, have you been able to pinpoint? For the Hispanic population, I think the genetic data is quite clear.
Yeah.
But for the Polynesian, it's...
It's as clear that it aggregates in families and suggests to us that genes have to be important.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do you do? You're a researcher. Or you've got a laboratory. You have a clinic on the border.
We have a clinic on the border.
What's your activity? What are you going to do to stop this? You're our white knight.
We're trying to be. So our hope is that we're going to understand what causes diabetes. Right now, somebody asks us, why do I have diabetes? And it's pretty simple. We can tell them, well, you're over 40. You have a family history of diabetes. You're Hispanic, and they have higher rates of diabetes. And you're overweight.
And none of that helps.
None of it helps. You can't do anything about any of those. You can't change how old you are.
Right,
you can't change. Yeah, you can't do this. And so our hope is if we can find the genes and use the technologies available to us, identify genes that lead to susceptibility, then we can tell a person, well, you have diabetes because at this gene you have this form of it that changes the flow of glucose into the cells. It makes it easier or harder to get glucose into the cells. And at this gene and this gene and this pathway. And so that's what we're trying to find. Over the years, we found one gene specific that we found many years ago and published this in 2000. Doesn't seem like many years ago, but it's a decade ago now.
That's 100 years in science.
It is,
often.
Yeah,
right.
Thinking when we were throwing DNA away not too long ago. And so today, ourselves and then other groups have done large-scale studies where we've looked at tens of thousands of different genetic variants. And in fact, now we're looking at a million genetic variants at a time and have identified about 25 different genes that appear to be involved in diabetes susceptibility. Now, that's just the first step. That just tells us here's 25 genes. Now what do we do with those genes? Well, that's not the kind of research I do. That's the kind of research other people do. My job is to find genes and say, boy, work on this one and let's figure out what it does. What happens with this gene?
So what goes on in your clinic? Because you're not just a laboratory exponent.
So we have a field office in Rio Grande City, and we see people every day in the office. And we do an examination. We get blood samples on them. We do EKGs. Depending on the study, we might do an oral glucose tolerance test. We'll do echocardiography to look at the structure and function of the heart. We measure their blood pressure. We do pretty much a complete physical examination so that when we find the genes, then we can ask, okay, how does it influence glucose levels, insulin levels, blood pressure levels? What target is the target?
So it's a big statistical analysis in a sense.
Yes.
All right.
So we collect.
So you have statisticians and galore, in fact.
Yeah, that's why my training at Michigan, I did a master's in statistics as well, because at the end we can collect samples on people, and we've collected data on about 28,000 different people. We've done genotypes in the last study. We've done a million different genotypes on 2,000 people, and we're in the process of analyzing that.
Clearly, the sort of the holy grail here, I suppose, is since there's a genetic component, I mean a major one, predominant one, gene therapy is one of these buzzwords. Where are we in gene therapy today? Are we still in the Stone Age?
Yeah, we're not going to do gene therapy for diabetes anytime soon, I can assure you.
But what does that mean? 50 years? 100 years?
Maybe never.
Ah, tell me why.
Because in the end, there's not one gene that causes diabetes. We've got 10, 15, we're at a list of 25. We have a list of 500 genes that we think are really good ones that might be involved in diabetes. And each one has a small effect. And so we're going to have commonalities why two people have diabetes, might gene 1, 2, and 5 in one person and 3, 6, and 8 in the other person. And so there's not going to be a standard rule there. But as we find the genes determine our metabolism. And it's in the change in metabolism that we might be able to manipulate. Hey, this gene in a high-fat diet, that's the worst thing you can possibly do. And we're not going to change the gene. We're going to change the diet.
Good luck.
Well, or we're going to change medications.
Right.
And there may be more prospects for that, because here's we find a gene and it tells us this is a pathway that we might be able to manipulate by using drugs. So just like we can lower blood pressure, we can lower glucose levels, we can do other things.
Over the last 30, 40 years, I grew up as a bit of a smoker. I stopped quite rapidly.
Good. Yeah.
But others in my family didn't, and they died because of lung cancer, etc. Nowadays, people don't smoke very much. And partly that's advertising. We see these incredibly nasty pictures of people who've got jaw cancer or lip cancer or whatever. Maybe more graphic illustrations of a cut-off leg, you know, right? Or whatever. Is that a strategy which people are thinking? Just scare the hell out of people so that they wake up and treat themselves properly.
Well, I think in areas like here where diabetes is so frequent, most people are aware of somebody who's had some of those complications. So I'm not sure that scaring them that way is really what is going to be the solution to it. Because we start talking about genetics, people start to think, well, it's genetic. I can't do anything about it. I'm going to get diabetes no matter what.
So maybe that's a good reason to avoid that.
And that's
approach.
The place that we have to work on is that, no, you're not determined to have diabetes. You might have an increased susceptibility for it, but there's lots of people that have an increased susceptibility that don't develop diabetes. So what is it that they do? Well, they watch their diet. They exercise. They make sure that they have physical activity every day. They're careful with those kinds of things. And they can stop the development of diabetes, and they can stop the development of the complications most of the time. So I wouldn't scare them as much. But if they don't do those things, then we have some others to look forward to.
People tend to do things when they think either they're going to get caught, like red traffic lights, or they really are getting close and they realize, hey, this is scary. It's a sociological feature.
And we have individuals who think, I don't want to start taking insulin because if I start taking insulin, I'm going to become like Aunt so-and-so or Uncle so-and-so who lost a limb. And no.
The reverse is true.
Insulin's the greatest thing ever because it keeps our blood sugar low and it keeps us from developing these things.
Craig Harness, professor of epidemiology and human genetics at the University of Texas Health Science Center, Houston, thank you so much for being on Science Studio.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So thank you very much, and we'll be back again next week with another riveting Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. A nursing professor at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces will launch a new research project in Anthony, New Mexico. The project will mobilize the small community into driving its own healthcare systems, education, and policymaking with the underpinning focus on healthy eating and physical activity. This patient-driven project runs through October 14th. Read more at the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.